Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Oklahoma Center for the Humanities presents a lecture tonight with writer-activist Herb Boyd. Boyd is a journalist, an educator, author, and activist for civil rights. He currently teaches Black Studies at City College of New York and writes for the New York Amsterdam News, America's oldest Black newspaper. His books include Brother Man, The Odyssey of Black Men in America, Baldwin's Harlem, a biography of James Baldwin, and this year's Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. Boyd graduated from Wayne State in Detroit and later taught there for 12 years, establishing the university's Black Studies program there in the late 1960s. And while he was there, he heard a riveting account about the Tulsa race riot from the early American Black radical Harry Haywood. He later became a member of the American Communist Party. He was at one point a member of the secretive African Blood Brotherhood, a Black liberation group which was active only for a few short years in the late 19-teens and the early 20s. In fact, there was a chapter here in Tulsa. But did Haywood really witness the Tulsa race riot? That's a question Boyd is still trying to pin down the answer to and is at the heart of his lecture tonight on the TU campus. Another view of the Tulsa race riot takes place tonight at Turrell Hall Auditorium at 7 o'clock, and Herb Boyd joins me as my guest today. Herb Boyd, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
You're going to be talking about the Tulsa race riot and what you call another view of the Tulsa race riot, and it's written through a little-known organization, I think, to most Americans, which... Well, tell us about the African Blood Brotherhood. Which is Harry Haywood is the
Members, a member of the organization, Harry Haywood. Harry Haywood, you have to understand a little bit about him, too, because you're talking about someone I met at Wayne State University campus in the late 70s. He arrived there after, of course, traveling all over the world. What an amazing odyssey this man had gone off during the 1930s in terms of fighting in Spain, had been affiliated with a number of radical organizations.
I went to the Soviet Union, sort of the American Communist Party.
Exactly. He's going to be later on, you know, after this experience with the African Blood Brotherhood, he will become like a member of the Communist Party in this in America here. But, you know, in terms of the Black thesis, the whole Black Belt theory, mm-hmm. that was pretty much his creation, you know, of kind of carving out five states in the South that would be like the homelands for Black people. Right. But his connection to the African Blood Brotherhood really started a year after. You know, I had to do some research on this because when he appeared on campus, and I had heard a bit about him before in reading about radical American history and everything, and to see that he was very much a mover and shaker inside of the movement. And when he arrived on campus, I was stunned to see him. And I said, well, here's an opportunity. So I invited him into the classroom after a few meetings with him and lunches and dinners and everything. And because at that time, he was pretty much like footloose and fancy free. Right. So he kind of looking for a place to settle, you know, because he was always a roamer anyway. So here he is in Detroit because of the kind of radical history and background we have in that city. That may have been part of the attraction. I never really got to the base of that. But here he was, and I say I have to take advantage of it because I was running the Black Studies Department at Wayne State University at that time. And I say, hey, we have this guy, here's a living opportunity for my students to have some contact with some of the people we've been reading and discussing. So I invited him into the classroom, and he talked about the Tulsa riot in such a vivid way. And it was just so intimate and so well connected in terms of feeling the emotions and everything that was connected there, that we were left with the impression that he was actually there and witnessed it all. So I kind of went with that and left it alone until later on, you know, his book came out, The Black Bolshevik came out, and I kind of looked for, you know, a better account of his experience in there, and there was nothing there. I say, well, have I kind of misconstrued some things about that presentation? I just got swept up in his emotional delivery to just assume that he was an eyewitness there. But he came into the ABB, the African Blood Brotherhood, in the summer after, because the Tulsa riot, of course, is in the summer of 1921, you know, May to June of 1921. He joined ABB in June of 1922. However, in being connected to the African Blood Brotherhood, he knew all about the rich history. So that's why he was in a position to talk about it in such vivid terms, you know, later on to my students. And at that time, you know, I wasn't going to be questioning him one way or another about the veracity of what he was talking about, and didn't do any research right away until his book came out. And I didn't see anything there. I didn't think anything of it, because the ABB was a secretive organization.
Tell us a little bit about the ABB.
ABB was really Cyril Briggs. And what I'll be doing in my presentation
now,
is talking.
Did it come out of World War I from ex-veterans who'd gone to Europe and seen we don't have this strict apartheid? You know, as we do
make the world safe for democracy. You know, right, right. We come back home and do the same thing. Of course, Harry's history, his odyssey, was very much like that. You know, because he stepped off the train in Chicago right in the middle. You know, the 1919 Red Summer, because that spread all over the country. And that may have been part of the impetus for the creation of the African Blood Brotherhood, that you had these uprisings, the kind of racial turmoil that was happening all over the country. Of course, they call it the Red Summer, more or less indicating the blood that flowed in the street. But of course, it had like some implications toward, you know, the Communist Party, too, in terms of the red aspect, because, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution had gone down 2 years before.
Well, you had to remember the Attorney General at that time, Palmer,
exactly.
Yeah, was conducting, you know, it was all about rooting out communists at that particular point. And so anytime there was unrest, it was usually connected in some way through the rhetoric to sedition and communism, even though in the case of both the Chicago race riot and the Tulsa race riot, it was whites basically rioting in African-American communities.
Yeah. Growing out of an incident there, of course, those are all the simmering discord and the kind of racial hostility and the contention between the rivalry between groups. It's a historic part of the American experience, you know, particularly when you come to African-Americans, no matter, you know, where they are, you know, they run into those circumstances. So here in Tulsa in 1921, I think the African Blood Brotherhood, you know, grounded as they were with kind of this militant radical outlook. And of course, later on, they're going to be accused as being the fomenters, you know, of that particular riot. And of course, the commander of the post here in Tulsa at the time, you know, disputed that and say, no, we had nothing to do with fomenting it. However, in terms of the defense of the African-American community, we're proud to say that we're part of that, you know. So it was neither confirmation, you know, or a dismissal in terms of the activity they had. That led me on my research. Let me get into it, you know. Let me find out, like, exactly what did they do, you know. So I got copies at the Tenement Library at New York University. I went down and started doing my research about a month ago to find out exactly, because I had seen some replicas of the Crusader publication that was kind of the organ or the newspaper or the magazine for the organization. And I found a whole collection of them put together by Robert Hill, a very fine scholar who had done a lot of work on Marcus Garvey. And so it's a collection of about 3 years of the Crusader under one cover. And I was principally concerned with just June and July of 1921. So because, you know, before when I had come out here, usually my family, my in-laws, you know, and some outlaws, live here, right here in Oklahoma, including nieces and nephews in Oklahoma City, and my sister-in-law, who is now a widow, and she's in Muskogee. My wife was born in Taft, which is just a little bit outside of Muskogee. So every summer for about 20 years, we came out for Memorial Day and go out to the grave sites and stuff like that. And the first time I came out here, which was like in 1987, 88, and I went straight to the Muskogee Library because I said, I'm going to find out about this 1921 Tulsa riot. I went into their archives and looked at newspapers, and almost every newspaper I looked at had been torn out. It was no mention of it. So I was going to later discover that that was something that was kind of an erasure. They kind of removed that out of memory. We don't want to talk about it. There's nothing in the papers about it. So that just made me all the more curious, you know, why is there no discussion about this? And so I continued my research, and for a while, I wrote about it in a couple occasions, but I just kind of pushed it aside. And so when I got the call from Sean, you know, to come on out here, he talked about James Baldwin. We'll talk about Baldwin, as I will be doing, with the students. I guess when this aired, I will have completed my tour of the campus and talking to some students about James Baldwin, and then, of course, getting ready for our Tuesday evening affair where we can really get into some of the discussion about the African Blood Brotherhood. It wasn't around that long. You know, as a matter of fact, only about 2 or 3 years of really active participation and a number of crisis moments in American history.
Was it in reaction to this violence between whites and blacks in the United States after World War One?
I think a little bit of that certainly was the kind of the general, the racism and bigotry, discrimination, Jim Crow. I think they had this opposition to the Ku Klux Klan, which of course had a very, very strong presence here in Tulsa.
It was reviving at
exactly
right after World War One. Yeah.
Right, because then, of course, it goes all the way back to the end of the Civil War, you know, when Nathan Bedford Forrest, you know, the war was never over for him. So he went home to Pulaski, Tennessee, and created the Klan there. But they had this revival with Woodrow Wilson coming into the White House, you know, the whole Birth of a Nation.
Right.
That came out in 1915, 1917. It was a very critical 2 or 3 years that kind of like seminal moments in terms of creating the kind of reaction, this his militancy coming from the African Blood Brotherhood. They were not alone. There were a number of other organizations out there, but they got some prominence because, first of all, they were based in New York. So with the whole Garvey movement at that time, and they stood pretty much in opposition to Garvey's black nationalism because they were moving more and more to the left and more Marxist outlook on life. So when you have the Ku Klux Klan, you have the lynchings, the whole widespread number of lynchings, and of course there are a number of other conflicts right here in Oklahoma, Dewey, Oklahoma. And one of the people I discovered, and I want to talk about him a little bit more, is A.G. Smitherman. What a remarkable individual. You talk about Buck Franklin, certainly, or the people who were Stratford, you know, the individual Peg Leg Taylor, you know, some of these individuals who out there that I read about in looking at the Tulsa Commission that they did in 2001.
Now, Peg Leg Taylor was the leader of a group of African Americans who basically went to the jail to make sure that Dick Rowland, who was who's the man who was arrested for whatever happened in an elevator.
Yeah, there's another kind of like, can we get to the bottom of that?
Never will.
Yeah.
But they were there to prevent him from being lynched.
Exactly. Yeah. I read about him looking through, and of course, John Hope Franklin, you know, Buck's son. Yeah. And of course, I had a chance to be with him a couple times in a very, very intimate situation where we had interviews and everything. At one point at Wayne State University, I had won like a scholarship to go to University of Chicago and study with John Hope Franklin. I had that opportunity. I turned it down because I was already teaching at Wayne State University, making $8,000 a year. Well, I'm going to go out and get what I need a degree for. I'm already doing it. And I started teaching as an undergraduate there. So anyway, I missed that opportunity. But later on, we had a couple of occasions. And of course, I used his books in my classroom. I never knew that much about his father, though. And so this research, you know, like, and we were earlier talking about the planes, and because I had heard, see, the African Blood Brotherhood was the first to point out the facts that this was the first time an American city had been bombed, you know, and so that was another part that spurred me into the research to find out a little bit more about that incident. And was that actually, did it actually occur?
And of course, that's very controversial to this day because a lot of white Tulsans say it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you have these African-American accounts. You mentioned B.C. Franklin. Mm-hmm. His account says, he never comes out and says that it,
explicitly, not explicitly.
But he said, what are we to believe of all these planes that were circling North Tulsa and leaving, coming back, and All of a sudden, these balls of turpentine from roofs falling in the city of Tulsa, boiling turpentine. And, he says, what are we to believe? And he's sort of making this sort of very left-handed accusation. And of course, they were being bombed.
Well, he's not alone in that particular thing. There's a few others who, I think Scott Ellsworth is one of the leading historians on there. He seems to go along with it to a certain degree from some other informants who reported to him, that it occurred. But be that as it may, we know the destruction there occurred, and my concern was to see that the African Blood Brotherhood and all of the research that I was doing, and even Scott Ellsworth only has a couple of citations in his book, and I guess his book is considered to be the definitive discussion on that.
The Promised Land.
Yeah, because he was brought into the commission. Of course, John Hope Franklin had him as a student, and he did his PhD dissertation on that, and ultimately was recommended to join the 11-member body of the Tulsa Commission on the Riot. And I only saw a couple citations in his book about the African Blood Brotherhood, and none of the other historians ever even mentioned them. So that just spurred my curiosity even more, is that how come you have the Crusader with all of these here commentaries and editorials and stories coming from them, yet and still, when they do the research on it, there's no mention of them whatsoever. But that's true with the riot in general, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My guest today is Herb Boyd. He is a journalist, educator, and author, teaches Black Studies at the City College of New York. Most recent book of many is titled Black Detroit, A People's History and Self-Determination. He'll be giving an Oklahoma Center for Humanities lecture, Another View of the Tulsa Race Riot, tonight at 7 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. So why do people disregard these accounts from the Brotherhood? Do you think it was because they felt like, for whatever reason, the scholars thought it might be more propaganda than truth, or what exactly?
I think, you try to get your arms around that and understanding. First of all, you have a general reaction anyway coming from the mainstream media, from the left in this country, in terms of how they begin to sum up another organization, another group. Eventually, the African Blood Brotherhood kind of morphs right into the Communist Party. And, of course, that would make them persona non grata, right away. We talked about the whole Palmer and the FBI and later on with J. Edgar Hoover, in terms of the general kind of attack on anything red in this country. You're a pinko, you better hide everything under the table, to do with Marx and Lenin, and of course later on with Castro and Mao Zedong and what have you. So there's always this general climate in this country, kind of a reactionary, in fact, when it comes to the militancy and people on the left and anybody espousing, any kind of a communistic outlook. So they fell into that kind of purview. They right away was like, uh-oh, they're seen as dangerous, they're talking about plotting to overthrow the government, the whole Smith Act, the sedition and stuff like that, all of that colored their particular experience. And of course, Harry was very much involved in that. Harry Haywood. We can get a lot of that from out of the Black Bolshevik, his autobiography.
Right. It's interesting. He actually broke with the Communist Party at some point because he felt like they weren't radical enough, because he actually believed in Black self-determination.
Sure.
And he was about setting up a homeland.
Exactly.
For Blacks in America.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Communist Party abandoned that idea and said,
yes,
at some point he eventually broke with them.
Exactly. I think a number of African Americans who were party members at that time were very disappointed in the kind of turn, because they had experienced a similar kind of turn early on in terms of the United Front aspects of the 1930s and what have you, and how the Russian government and how they identify, because they're united in one say, next thing you know, we're enemies. And so they get caught up in this year kind of shifting ideological turns, philosophical, political turns that's going on between governments. And so, what happens with us? I thought we had an issue that was of paramount importance, and suddenly it's scrapped, it's tossed aside. So Harry talked about that as well as the Tulsa riot when he addressed my students. But that, I don't think that was understood by them. It was a little bit too difficult.
So getting back to Harry Haywood and this idea that you heard him talk about the Tulsa race riot, it was like he was there.
Uh-huh.
So did you find out? Was he there? Did he have this direct connection? Was it something he was putting together from accounts, or is there a story there?
Well, I'm still kind of, my position is this: if he had actually been there, and it's been so many years thereafter, he's no longer concerned about being connected with the organization, because if you go back and read the Crusader, they never identify who that commander is of the post. You know, that name is deleted and scrubbed out. So, and no people had come forward at that time to say, because of the accusations and allegations that had been made, that they were the fomenters of the riot. So they had to take a step back. So the whole kind of secrecy aspect of it, you figure that would have been removed some 40, 50 years later when he's writing about it, that he can now proudly say that he was a part of it. So it leads me to believe that either I was kind of confused or misconstrued what he was saying to my students at that time, and all of us was kind of swept up in it at that time, because he was such a vivid explanation, such a wonderful recounting, as though he was actually there experiencing it. And he may have given us that indication in order to give it a little bit more authenticity. You know, I don't want to go that far with it. I was kind of like blaming it on myself and saying that I got swept up in that moment. But it was kind of like the eyewitness accounts. You know, here we are at 9/11, and, you know, I was an eyewitness to that. Yeah, I can say that I was an eyewitness. What do you mean you were an eyewitness? So I was there, and I watched both buildings come down, you know, and I photographed it and documented everything, and had done the previous one when the building was hit several years before. So I can say that I was an eyewitness there, but I wasn't there all throughout. I think Harry may have been dispatched to Tulsa a year after to begin to look at the situation. However, he never wrote about that either. But there's a lot of stuff he didn't write about. You know, autobiographies, you know, it's a very selective memory, you know, in terms of what you want to go back over. And some of that stuff maybe he didn't want to talk about, possibly. But I have no concrete evidence that he was ever there. You know, I was trying to find that, you know, what he wrote about it, maybe someplace, a fugitive piece that he wrote that never got included in his autobiography. But whether he was there or not, what he told my students, it spurred us all to do our research on the Tulsa riot at that time. And, of course, you know, it was still not a lot of information available, you know. But now you find, after the commission and Scott's Ellsworth. And
there's a number of books.
I mean, Bucks and John Hope Franklin. Even John Hope Franklin, if you go through his book on slavery and freedom, you know, not that much about the Tulsa riot in it at all, you know. And I don't know if that's just because you have such a broad and comprehensive look at African-American history. How are you going to give that any more play than, let's say, the 1943 riot of Detroit or the 1967 rebellion, you know, because those are much, I mean, they were disasters, but hey, Tulsa thing was what, 300? It's not sure yet how many people were killed there. So it's one of the largest, and of course, being bombed, all of that gives it a kind of special significance, or it should give it a special significance. So let's see how much we can get into that, you know, this evening in China. Maybe I hope to see and hope a lot of people. Discussions like this is to start the renew and maybe the new research. The only thing I'm bringing new to this is the African Blood Brotherhood. That pushed me into it, and I'll be showing the people there some evidence, what I've gathered, and they can reach their own conclusion about the, you know, what actually happened there, the role that they played. But seemingly they were very, very involved, you know, particularly in the defensive way of protecting the community in the same way that Peg Leg Taylor, you know, took a stand.
In our remaining time, let's talk about your most recent book, which is Black Detroit, which is a whole history of Detroit through a black lens, going all the way back to colonial times.
Whoa.
When you discovered a gentleman named William Kenny, who escaped, I guess, his slave master,
right.
Settled in which I assume Detroit at that particular point was like a frontier outpost, And you found this remarkable letter where he's basically taunting his former master, saying, I'm free.
Very sarcastic letter, yeah. You know. It's like, oh, huh, I'm here. I got away from you. And good riddance, you know. But, you know, William Kenney is just one of so many remarkable individuals. I mean, William Lambert is one that really amazed me. And Thornton Blackburn and Lucy Blackburn.
So tell us about William Lambert.
Lambert was one of the foremost conductors of the Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad had kind of a natural terminus, you know, in Detroit, because it's right across the river from Canada, right. You know. And people run away, fugitive slaves, running away from bondage, as the Blackburns would do in the 1830s, arrive in Detroit and think they're in a sanctuary. They have a refuge, a safe, you know, escape. And then the bounty hunters started looming on the set, and they grabbed them off. And that created a lot of tension and turmoil in the city of people saying, no, you're not going to take them. And ultimately, a riot breaks out in 1833, the first real major riot in the city around the Blackburn affair. Eventually, they are escaped, and they're kind of ferreted across the Detroit River, thanks to, again, William Lambert and a number of other abolitionists at that time. You know, people see a lot of people don't realize that slavery was in Detroit, because it's a part of the Northwest Territory. Right. And of course, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 said it outlawed slavery in the territory. But we recognize a distinction between de jure and de facto. You know, people are, we had so many slaveholders, not slave masters, we had slaveholders in the city of Detroit. And you can look around the city and see monuments and street names and school names all after these individuals. And so I guess this general climate that we're enduring now, where people are tearing down monuments connected to the Confederacy or slavery and what have you. Well, Detroit got quite a few of them, you know, and name changes that have to occur, what have you. But again, you know, the whole book covers 300 years of history, and you have to be, you know, how are you going to do that? You know what I mean? There's certain key moments that you have to kind of pinpoint. And for me, I think each decade has a remarkable episode that I can focus on. I don't have to work that hard, you know, say, here it is, you know, what, 1930s, 1950s, arson of democracy, World War II. You know, you talk about the Henry Ford, $5 a day, attracting you workers to come to work at the Ford Motor Company. I mean, that was a dramatic change in terms of the economic possibilities of Black Americans.
And we think with the automotive industry, this created the emergence of perhaps the largest Black middle class, the earliest in America.
Exactly. That's a key point that I make in the book. Yeah. One of the reviewers said, Herb, you spend too much time with the Black elite. And I think, well, the Black working class there is really my central concern, you know. And I try to follow them across time, whether they were, you know, cutting down the trees and paving the first roads there, or whether they were working as stevedores, you know, on the waterfront, whether they were working in the whole rise of industrial Detroit, making stoves. At one point, Detroit was the largest stove maker in the nation. Mm-hmm. And African-American workers were right there at the point of production. You know, they were working right on the lines and in the boiler rooms in the factories, as they would do during the rise of the automobile industry. So that is the beginning. You're absolutely right in terms of stabilizing and creating this here very, very important Black middle class that then would spur some other activities on the cultural front. Because once you can get that decent job and you got that, that house with 2.5 children and a picket fence, you know, you're on your way. And then you got a basement and you got an attic, you got a backyard, you got a front yard, you got a driveway, you maybe even got two cars. You dig it? So that was a part of that Black middle class experience that I grew up with.
Herb, thanks very much for joining
us. It's a pleasure.
Writer, activist Herb Boyd speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be speaking tonight in Tyrrell Hall Auditorium at 7 o'clock with a lecture titled Another View of the Tulsa Race Riot. He's also the author of a new book, Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.